Okay, good evening. There are more copies that are being made currently, so if you don't have copies of the source sheet, you will be getting it very soon. I want to thank, first of all, Yoni Tights. Yoni is the direct impetus for this year, and the indirect impetus is Reva Prale. Basically, Reva has a wonderful program in the shul, which is called the Friday Night Lights and Learn, something to that effect. And at one of the sessions of Friday Night Lights and Learn, daytime edition, so Yoni Tait spoke, and he spoke about Bishul Akam. And I'm not exactly sure what you said, so I hope I'm not quoting you wrong, but I think Yoni brought up some of the issues about Bishul Akam, and this led to a lot of questions. So because there were so many questions that people were asking about Bishul Akam, so then they asked me, well, could I give a share about Bishul Akam? So that's why I'm here. That's the basic idea of tonight. The title of the shiur is So You Think You Can Eat, and that is in parentheses. It's Bishul Akam Basics. We're talking about potato chips, sushi, corn, and cranberries. And we're also going to leave time to talk about anything that you want to discuss with respect to Bishul Akam. Bishul Akam is the big issue in kashrus today. Right? By the way, Bishul Akam does not mean cooking non-Jews. Okay? Word for the wise. Bishul Akam means when a non-Jew cooks for you. And the Gemara tells us, the Mishnah in Avodah Zarah, Daf Lamed Hey Amud Beis, it's the first source on your sheet for those of you who have sheets. It says, the following items of non-Jews are forbidden, right? Ve'ein yisurin iser hanoa, meaning that it's not forbidden to derive benefit from. You just can't eat it. And the items on this list are the milk of non-Jews, right? Chol of Yisrael is not just a weird chumrah, etc. Right? Chol of Yisrael is actually a halacha that's found in the Mishnah. Right? And then the bread of the non-Jews, and the oil of the non-Jews, and the shluckles, and the cooked items of non-Jews. Cooked items of non-Jews are treif. That means as follows. If you decide, and now I am quoting a rabbi from a few miles away, just over the bridge, a rabbi of one of our modern Orthodox shuls. He spoke Shabbos Shuvah 2 years ago, and he told his congregants, he said, listen, if you decide to tell people, let's go out for a movie Saturday night, and then after the movie, we're going to a diner to just eat, basically what you're saying is, let's go to have treif together. Because when you go into a diner to eat food, even if all the ingredients are perfectly kosher, you have an OU on everything, right? It is still treif. That is shluckos. That is cooked items of non-Jews. Bishul Akam is non-kosher. Right? This can't really be sugar-coated. I apologize for those who want niceness and tolerance and everything like that. We can't sugarcoat this one. It's non-kosher. That's it. Right? The food is just non-kosher. Now this, of course, is the big issue that comes up in kashrus today. Because I can ascertain that all of the ingredients are going to be kosher. But what do I do in the factory where they are making, pick your item, right? I don't have a yidol over there who's turning on the fires. So how do I solve Bishul Akam problems? This is the biggest issue. I brought in my folder tonight. The OU has a book that's going to be coming out soon. It's the OU Principles of Bishul Akam. This is a pre-copy of the OU Bishul Akam book. They go through basically all of the products, and we got to figure out. Here's the product list, right? Canned items, artichokes, asparagus. Which ones are going to be problematic, Bishul Akam or not? Cranberry sauce, green beans, right? There's around, I don't know, 500 items on this list. Right? This is the big issue in kashrus. And it's even a bigger issue if you go away, you go on a cruise. My friend Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg from Boca Raton drafted a series of guidelines for what to do on the cruise. My parents go on cruises. They're at that stage in life, thank God. It's a really good stage in life. I can't wait. Right? So you get to a certain stage.
It's a little boring.
What?
It's a little boring.
You know, I could handle it. I'm ready to be bored. Right? It doesn't sound so bad. You go and you just sit there on the deck. I asked my parents, what do you do on the cruise? My father's like, I learned Daf Yomi and I sit on the deck. Okay. Doesn't sound so bad. But that's what you do. You reach a certain person who I used to work with, like spoke about going on a no-Jews cruise, right? That's like a tradition. The fact is that you go on the cruise, you have to figure out how the food is going to be kosher. Even if you know all the ingredients are kosher, but you're not cooking it yourself, the people cooking it for you are presumably non-Jews, that means that the food is going to be forbidden based on Bishul Akum. So how do we permit it? Right? What can be done? There are ways around it, but we have to learn the rules. So before we begin to learn the rules, basically, what's the reason for the prohibition of Bishul Akum? There are two reasons that are cited in the poskim. Both reasons are quoted by Rashi. Right? Rashi was not two different people. Rashi was one person, but sometimes he gives you two different reasons. So Rashi writes in Avodah Zarah and Lamed Hey that the reason why it's forbidden is Mishum Chasnus, that the concern is because of intermarriage. Right? Basically, the way to a guy's heart is through his stomach. Right? I think that's standard. And the concern is that if you're going to give them non-Jewish cooked food, you might come to marry the non-Jewish woman. That's one reason that Rashi writes in Avodah Zarah. Elsewhere in Avodah Zarah, and Tosis refers to this two sources from now that the source sheets are going around, you'll be able to follow even better. Tosis writes that there's a different Rashi, where Rashi says that the reason for Bishul Akum, the reason why it's non-kosher, is because Shema Yachilenu Davar Tameh. A non-Jew is going to cook for you. What might happen is the non-Jew is going to take some treif and add it to the pot. So there are two separate reasons why Bishul Akum is forbidden. Now, which of these two reasons is governing? Basically, we assume that the reason that's governing as a matter of halacha is the reason of chasnus. The real reason is intermarriage. Meaning to say, right, even in a situation that we know for sure there is no concern that non-kosher food got stuck in the pot, it still is going to be forbidden. Why? Because intermarriage. For example, let's say the non-Jew is cooking in my own house. No? My house. I hope I have no non-kosher ingredients in my house. I try to keep that standard. No, I'm a rabbi, what can I do? But the fact is, right, you try to make sure there's no non-kosher in your house. So there's no non-kosher. The non-Jew is cooking. Still, the food is non-kosher because that's called Bishul Akum. Now, there is a ravid. The famous Ravid, Rabbi Avraham ben David, the Ravid on the Rambam. This is, to my knowledge, the only time the Ravid is quoted in Tosfos. The Ravid says that if a guy cooks in a Jew's home, the food is kosher. The Ravid, right, died 1197, kind of cool. Right? The Ravid says that the food is going to be kosher. The Ravid is not accepted as a matter of halacha, but we do use the Ravid kind of through the back door. There's a discussion in Shulchan Aruch here. If you look in Se'if Dalet on the first page, Shulchan Aruch discusses what about Shvachos Shalanu? Let's say our maidservants cook. I grew up in Lawrence, so they used to speak about in Lawrence how there was an epidemic called maids. That was like the joke that everyone said. I'm sorry. But the fact is, it's mean, right? The fact is that if your maid cooks for you, so Shulchan Aruch has different opinions, two opinions, whether the food is going to be kosher or not. We try not to rely on it. The rationale behind the permissive opinion might be this Ravid. But the fact is, we assume that the food that is cooked by a non-Jew, even though we know there's no non-kosher ingredients in it, the food is still non-kosher. Kosher because of the reason of intermarriage. This, of course, has some leniencies that are applied. No, let's say you have a Jew who is not only non-observant, but you have a Jew who is a mummer. Let's say you have a Jew who is an apostate. The guy, the girl, whatever, it could go both ways. It could be a male or a female. They decide to embrace a different religion. So what's the halacha of the food that's cooked by a mummer? So that should also depend on these two reasons. If the reason for Bishul Akum is because Shema Yachilanu Davar Tameh, maybe it's going to be treif, yeah, you have to wait, this guy's going to give you treif. But if the reason is because of intermarriage, you might marry the daughter of the person who's cooking the meal for you. Interestingly, apparently men cooked. Right? That's the issue. Now, so if the concern is that you might marry the daughter of the guy who's cooking for you, so the daughter of the mummer is a fine Jewish girl. She goes to Beis Yaakov or Stern College, whatever it is. So the fact is, it would seem that that would be permitted. That's also two opinions in Shulchan Aruch, but that seems to be permitted. One of the issues that comes up with Bishul Akum that is most difficult in our community, at least in the Mount Sinai community, I think the issue is less acute. But I remember dealing with this as a kid. My grandmother, Leha Shalom, reached a stage in life that she couldn't really take care of herself, and we had full-time help. So what about all the food that's cooked in my grandmother's house? Is the food kosher? Or is there a problem with Bishul Akum? Now, it's not a simple question. Honestly, it depends on the type of stove you have in some ways. And we in Washington Heights have it better than in most communities. I don't want to take a survey. How many people, maybe I will take a survey. How many people have the old-fashioned landlord
gas stove
with a pilot light? Wow. Okay. Right? And how many people have actually a new modern stove that's from after the year 1950? Oh, wow. We have two.
One.
What? One. Got it.
1950?
So the fact is that if your stove is a stove that's an old-fashioned landlord special, you have a kula by Bishul Akum if you are Ashkenazi. Let's explain. There is a halacha of hashlachas kisim. Hashlachas kisim means if you just throw a little match into the fire, a guy lights a fire, and the Jew comes and just throws a match into the fire. So Sfaradim say that doesn't solve any problems. Sfaradim say that works in terms of pasakum. The bread baked by a non-Jew will become permitted if you just throw a match in. But for Bishul Akum, according to Mechaber, and according to Elijah Kramer of Vilna, according to the Gra also, the food is treif with hashlachas kisim. Right? A guy throws a little bit into the... the guy lights the fire. Jew throws a little match in. For Sfaradim, the food remains treif. For the Gra, the food remains treif. But for the Ramah, the food becomes kosher. Not only for the Ramah is the food kosher if the Jew throws a twig and adds a teeny bit to the fire, but if the Jew lights or a fire, and the guy takes a fire from that fire that the Jew lit, that also is enough to permit the food, at least b'di'eved, providing we also have the rye, but it's in the Jewish home. Eish from Eish, the comment of the Sefer Isser v'Heter with the notes of the Zer Zohav on the bottom, Eish me Eish is only permitted in a Jewish home when we also have this rye to rely upon. That means that in my grandmother's old apartment, the food was actually kosher, no? Because she had an old landlord special, providing that a Jew lit the pilot light, the food is going to be kosher. But if the pilot light was not lit by a Jew, so then the food could be treif, no?
But the pilot light, unless it goes out, is usually going on all the time.
If the pilot light, so hopefully it was lit by a Jew originally, years ago, right? If it goes out, if a Jew relights it, you're fine, right? But if a non-Jew lights it, so then we're going to be in trouble.
I guess if you're not sure who lit it originally.
If you're not sure who lit it, so Bishul Akum remains an Isser D'Rabbanan and a Suffolk D'Rabbanan we could be Mekel on.
Blow it out and put it back on.
So you could do that also, right? A Jew comes and blows it out, puts it back on, that could work. But the fact is, this is a very big issue in terms of caring for the elderly, to just make sure that the food is kosher. By the way, FYI, when the food in Bishul Akum cases is non-kosher, not only is the food non-kosher, there are two opinions in Shulchan Aruch as to whether the pots become non-kosher also. I think I have this somewhere in the source sheet. But we assume that the pots also become treif.
And the dishes?
What? The dishes, probably not, because the dishes in most cases will be a klisheni.
Oh.
But the fact is the pots also, we assume, become treif. That's two opinions in Shulchan Aruch, but generally we're machmer on that. Yeah, Riva?
So the pilot light has to be lit by a Jew.
If the pilot light was lit by a Jew, and then a guy takes from that fire, which was originally by a Jew, and lights a new fire, that would be kosher in a Jewish home.
What if, like, your pilot, I mean, this has happened to me, that, like, the pilot like, goes out and it was, like, on Yantip, I think, and our super came and, like, we lit it. Does that mean that the...
But again, you're still doing the cooking because you're putting the pot on the fire.
Okay. So
right? The cook... In a case, though, like with my grandmother, Lashon, she wasn't cooking anything.
Right.
The guy was cooking everything. The only thing that a Jew did is this tiny, tiny little bit called lighting a pilot light. Right? So lighting a pilot light will help Bidi Eved in a Jewish home. Right? That's basically the way the halacha boils down as far as I understand it. Yeah?
It's a little bit off topic, but how about intravenous feeding to old people in nursery homes? Is there any issue of
intravenous feeding? It's not really cooked. There's nothing, right?
It's not cooking.
Right? You're not cooking. It's just, it's all cold. You don't want it hot when it goes in your veins. Right? It's cold. Yeah. So I think that's not Bishul Goyim. The only possible issue in those cases is some Shabbos issues in terms of drawing blood to get the line in. Generally speaking, you know, people need it. It's Bekuach Nefesh for the food, so it's okay. Yeah. Ophira? So Path Akum, we assume, is more lenient than Bishul Akum. Right? We eat Goyish bread all the time, no?
But only in from
we eat Pas Palter all the time. Bishul is more strict. For example, let's go slowly. The concern of Bishul Akum, we assume, is if a guy is going to cook for you, you might marry the guy's daughter, right? That's the basic issue. It's by the way, this should tell us how bad intermarriage is. It's not a joke. Some people, someone from the community, someone from the community came over to me around 2 years ago, and she was very bothered. She said that she met a guy at work, a really nice guy, and they were getting along, and she was asking, like, what's so bad about marrying a non-Jew? It's very serious. Look at how many gezeros Chazal have that we're worried you might marry a non-Jew, so therefore don't eat the food, right? Intermarriage is really, 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 really bad, right? It's there. So in terms of Bishul Akum in factories, so the question that comes up is, one second, right? If the whole reason is I might marry the daughter, will people forgive me if I take off my jacket? That's just, it's hot. Okay, Bishul Akum in factories, if the whole concern is that I might marry the girl or the daughter of the person who cooked the food for me, but the person cooking the food for me is out in Minnesota somewhere, I have no idea who cooked the food, it's made in some massive factory, how could I possibly marry the daughter? What exactly is the concern? So there is a Birkei Yosef, the Chida quotes in the Truba, the Maharitatz. The Maharitatz was part of that generation in Sfat. The Maritatz permitted Bishul Akum in large factories, but the Maritatz's position was not accepted. We do accept the Maharitatz in one narrow sort of way. If food is made in a factory, and it's the type of food that you cannot possibly make at home, that requires specialized machinery or the like, so Rav Moshe Feinstein is quoted by Rabbi Greenblatt from Memphis. Rabbi Greenblatt was just Nifter, the Rivas Ephraim. So Rivas Ephraim quotes from Rav Moshe Feinstein that Rav Moshe was lenient in that case. Again, so in a case of a large factory, so you don't possibly know who cooked the food, so you can't possibly marry the daughter, still we're machmir. But if it's the type of factory that has specialized equipment that you can't possibly make food that looks like that in your house, in that case we are lenient. This is what we all rely on when we eat OU. Half of the OU products are based on this kula, no?
So we can eat bread. It's not
so bread is pasakum. Bread is a different thing. But let's say we're not talking about bread. Let's say we're talking about certain cereals, corn cereals or the like, right? Corn pops, corn flakes, right? Now, can you make stuff that looks like these things at home? I challenge you to try it. We actually did this years ago when I was in Moresh HaKolo with Rabbi Willig. He challenged us to try to make anything that looks like a cornflake. So you sit there with a hammer and you're banging on corn, then you're cooking it. It doesn't work. It doesn't really work. So the reality is that we assume that that is going to be permitted if it's the type of specialized equipment that you can't do at home and it's made in a large factory. Yeah?
Why are we lenient about that?
So we're lenient about that. Rav Moshe Feinstein felt that since it seems that the Mahari Tats should be correct. Right? If the reason of Bishul Akum is because of intermarriage, so in a large factory, the Svara should be that it would be permitted. We still forbid it because of some sort of low plug. We say, you know what, we won't make any exceptions. The rule is the rule. Leave it. But in a situation when I have a legitimate reason to assume that this case is different, so then we permit it. That is, I think, standard procedure. The OU is more machmir and Bishul Akum than many of the other kashrus agencies. We'll talk about some of these things in a minute, but I'm pretty sure that the standard approach is to be makel on that question, or else we couldn't eat a lot of food. I think Yechiel had a question in the back.
Yeah, just to step back to the rider and the pilot line issue. I'm sorry, the rider limits his pilot light cooler to a Jewish home, essentially. Or
we only rely on the pilot light cooler in a Jewish owned home when they also have the rider. We don't use the pilot light cooler on its own. We only combine it with the rider.
With the rider. So are there, then we're limited in the pilot light. That's in a Jewish home, and we couldn't extend that to a kosher establishment, or there are similarities?
So the assumption is that a kosher establishment, if it's non-Jewish owned, certainly, is more of a concern, because this person has a lot of trade. I have no trade food. I don't own any trade food. Right? Let's say Yil Sweets or somebody, if the guy would be kosher, which he isn't, really. We'll talk about that as we go on today. But the guy has a lot of trade food that he owns.
Yeah.
Right? So there's always a concern he's going to be bringing some of it into the store. So
a kosher establishment
owned by a kosher establishment owned by a Jew, owned by a kosher Jew. Right. So then the rider would be lean. Then we have the rider. That is what they rely on the RCBC in Teaneck, no? The RCBC only gives hashgacha on places based on a pilot light if it's a Jewish from owned establishment. Right. I think that's a very reasonable position. Yeah, Eric?
So what's, aside from the issue of them being open on Shabbos and the monitoring issue there, what's the basis that a lot of these vegan restaurants get their hashgachas around?
Yeah, so maybe we'll talk about that later on. If I don't get to it, please remind me before we're done. Okay.
So I just wondered, what's the difference between a factory and a restaurant? I mean, for the fact that I have no, connection with the person making food.
In a restaurant, I know who the person is. If you get a good meal, you can walk into the back and say, I really want to meet the chef, the soup was great. And that will establish a personal connection. In a factory, there's absolutely no way of knowing who made this cornflake that I really liked. Right? That's the fundamental difference.
So in a situation like that, just like a Dunkin' Donuts where it's baked in the factory and then brought over 2 hours later, that's like a factory. That's
correct. That's like a factory, 100%. Fine. So this is the basic issues in terms of the introduction. Now, Bishul Akum, we assume, applies only when the food is cooked by a non-Jew. If the food is processed by a non-Jew in some other way, then there is no prohibition of Bishul Akum. It has to be that the food is cooked. For example, if the non-Jew soaks the food, then it's not a problem. Again, on the second side of the page, in Se'if Yud Gimel, we have that type of case. If the food is soaked, it's not a problem. The issue is only when the food is cooked. The big issue that comes up in kashrus agencies, and there are different practices, I think in Elizabeth, anyone here from Elizabeth? Okay, correct. Is there a sign in the Dunkin' Donuts in Elizabeth that you cannot have the eggs that are made in the microwave? No?
I don't think so.
You don't think?
Everything is very strict.
They're very strict. Someone told me that different Dunkin'... There's these Dunkin' Donuts eggs. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
They look radioactive.
They make them or something.
What?
It's
They pre-make them and then they microwave them after. So the question is microwaving halachically considered cooking for purposes of Bishul Akum? This is a dispute between Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. It boils down to a dispute between different kashrus agencies who supervise various kosher Dunkin' Donuts. Again, I give a tshuva of the Shevet HaLevi over here, of Rav Wozner, who analyzes this issue. Generally speaking, the question is that really cooking? Today, it might be a normal way to cook, so one could argue that's considered cooking. On the other hand, certainly this is not the type of cooking that was around at the time of the Gemara. I don't think there was ever a microwave in Talmudic times, and I'm willing to be confident in that assessment, that there are no microwaves in Talmudic times. According to the Chazon Ish, since it wasn't around the Talmudic times, it certainly is going to be permitted. The Chazon Ish has a famous essay where he argues that the Gemara at the beginning of Avodah Zarah knows that there are 2,000 years that are called the years of Torah. The Chazon Ish says, what does that mean, that these 2,000 years are the years of Torah? Chazon Ish explains what that means is that all of the realia that established halacha had to be shored up during those 2,000 years. So, if something was there, now 2,000 years means 2,000 years after the birth of Avram Avinu. Avram Avinu was born in the year 1948. Okay? For the Zionists out there, right? Avram was born in 1948. So, from 1948 till 3948 are the 2,000 years that established realia in halacha, according to the Chazon Ish. Microwaves, to the best of my knowledge, were not around in the year 3948. Right? If that's the case, according to the Chazon Ish, a microwave is not called cooking in halacha. However, Rav Moshe Feinstein and others contend that if it's the normal way of cooking, so therefore it would be cooking in halacha. There are different approaches, different kashrus agencies. It's something that is worth focusing on. Okay, I want to talk with you briefly about...
Sorry, yeah. What was the situation you said before about that there is an impossibility of chasnos? Is that a tzad heter?
Yeah. I mean, again, it's a tzad heter in the sense of the Mahari Tatz is lenient. We generally a mahmir. But if it's the type of food that cannot possibly be cooked in the normal kitchen...
That would be the same as saying that Samyeno made grape juice. We can't...
So the issue over here is like the Magid Mishnah writes in a few places, we can't compare different gazeros. Samyeno is much stricter than other gazeros because of the possibility of Avodah Zarah, etc. Again, the conservative movement was lenient on Stam Yenom for that reason, but it's not accepted.
Because grape juice is osir and schnapps is mutter. Schnapps is a social drink.
Right, so that's already, that's going too far afield. Okay, let us talk about Bishul Akum in the specifics. There are two big kulas that are found in Bishul Akum in the Gemara. By the way, I didn't realize this when Riva asked me to give the shiur. We were trying to come up with a date for the shiur, but today is the Sunday of Parshas Devarim. And as a Parshas Devarim is very relevant for Bishul Akum, because the Gemara asks, what's the source of Bishul Akum in Chumash? How do you know in Chumash? So the Gemara says, well, we know Bishul Akum. This is Avodah Zarah, Lamed Zayin, Lamed Beis, going over to Lamed Ches. I didn't realize this until this afternoon. That's why it's not on the source sheet. But the Gemara says it's derived from the Pasuk in Parshas Devarim. Of Ochel Bakesef Tashbireni Vachalti Umayim, right? Titin Li Vishasisi Rakev Rabaraglai. So the Gemara derives from that Pasuk that seems to be the source of Bishul Akum. It has to be that ochel is like mayim, just like mayim doesn't change, just like water never changes, so also the food never changed. That's the only type of food that is permitted. Food that did change through a non-Jew would be forbidden. So then the Gemara says that can't possibly be the source because of a few technical reasons. And the Gemara concludes that the reason for Bishul Akum is Dirabbanan. It's a rabbinic prohibition based on what we mentioned before, either that the non-Jew might give me treif, or because of the concern of intermarriage. That's what it says in the Gemara. Now, the Gemara has a few kulas of Bishul Akum. There are a few leniencies that are put into place. They are as follows. Bottom of the first page, I think. Right? This is just straight from Shulchan Aruch. Dabar she'eino ne'achal kemo shehu chai. V'gam ola al shulchan malachim v'lafes bo es hapas ola parperes. Shebishul Akum, I feel bekli Yisrael, ube beis Yisrael is usher because of Bishul Akum. Okay? That basically summarizes everything. Let's take it apart. Davar she'eino nechal kamo shuchai. Bishul akum applies to food that is not edible raw. If the food is edible raw, there is no din of bishul akum. Presumably the rationale for this is that the food is edible ruah, so you're not going to feel a real connection to the guy who made the food for you. Because the guy didn't really improve the food. This food was edible beforehand, it's edible after. What did the guy do? He took edible food, he made it edible. Big whoop. That doesn't change anything. So if food was edible beforehand, so there is no problem of bishul akum. Additionally, the next reason that, or the next qualification of bishul akum is it has to be food that is ole al shulchan melachim, food that goes on the king's table. No?
Like falafel.
Like falafel. Every king eats falafel, as we know. We'll talk about that in a few moments. So to be a bishul akum food, it has to be something that's not edible ruah. What are examples of foods that are edible raw that are excluded from bishul akum?
Carrots.
Carrots. You can eat most vegetables are excluded from bishul akum because they are edible raw. Many of the canned vegetables, consequently, are not a problem of bishul akum, no? In my OU bishul akum list, in the canned vegetables, some of them are not edible raw. Asparagus are not edible raw. But
something like ketchup.
Ketchup.
It's cooked tomatoes,
so a tomato is edible raw, so ketchup would not be a problem. Now, of course, we have to always deal with the fact that maybe they would add a non-kosher ingredient in it. But if you know that there's no non-kosher ingredient, so if it's edible raw, there is no problem of bishul akum. Right? Olives are edible raw. Peaches are edible raw. Pears are edible raw. These things are not subject to the rules of bishul akum. So they do not require hechsher if you know for sure that the only ingredient is the vegetable. Sometimes there are, and the issue in kashrus today is that there's always, or very often, there are additional ingredients that are included, and we also have to contend with the fact that the machinery might be non-kosher. Matz applesauce, right? So matz applesauce has a triangle K, correct? So what they told me years ago is that the reason why triangle K is like a more questionable hashgacha, when I was working in the OU, what they told me, off the record, but I guess I'm putting it on the record now, but I said this before, is that one of the problems with the matz applesauce is that the matz factory, the way kashrus works is that you get the factory to sign a contract that we will only use ingredients from this approved list. And the matz factory refused to sign that they did not want clam juice. They refused to sign that clam juice would not be on the approved list. Now, clam juice is very unlikely that anyone would package in the same place that they make apple juice. Apparently, clam juice is very pungent. I've never tasted it. I don't know. So you'll have to correct me. But apparently, the taste is like really, really strong, and it would mess up the flavor of your apple juice. So you wouldn't put it on the same machinery. But the more reliable hashgachas don't want to give kashrus certification based on this type of assessment that they're not going to use it anyway, because if it's not on the list, if they didn't sign, they don't want to put it in.
Do we say that you can eat, can we say we think we need baked goods because the Gemara talks about eating raw wheat and saying that Mahana?
So eating raw wheat, does that help baked goods? So baked goods, first of all, are in a different category there in past, not bishul. But in terms of whether rua wheat is considered nechal kamo shehu chai, that gets involved in the next discussion, which I think it's somewhere on this sheet. Nechal ayadei hadachak. Here, you see, do I have a section that says something about cranberries and corn?
Yeah.
In the section of cranberries and corn, so there's a citation from Shulchan Aruch. About dagim ketanim shemochan Yisrael, if you have small fish that a Jew salted them, or a non-Jew salted them, so it's like they're somewhat cooked, etc. And then, dagim meluchin gedolim, big salty fish, are only edible ayadei hadachak, therefore if a goy roasts them, they are forbidden, and some permit it. In other words, Shulchan Aruch has two opinions about if I have food that is edible ruah, that's what we call edible ayadei hadachak. In other words, most people don't eat it raw, but some people could, or some people do. No? What's in that category? So kose sasachito would probably be in that category also. If I could chew on a wheat kernel, corn is in this category, no? Apparently, I should have done this tonight. Like at our barbecue tonight, we decided to have a pre-9 days barbecue. So my wife bought like corn, and we roasted the corn on the grill. So I should have tried this as an experiment. But apparently, plain raw corn is edible. No?
If it's really, really sweet, if it's like, you know, fresh, you can actually eat corn.
Okay.
So
if the corn is edible when it's really raw, so therefore corn would not be subject to the rules of Bishul Agam, right? Now, if it's not really edible, if it's edible with difficulty, that's called Necha Ayudei HaDechak. Necha Ayudei HaDechak, Shulchan Aruch has two opinions, we are machmir on this, right? In other words, we assume that something is only edible with difficulty, so then we treat it as a problem in terms of Bishul Agam. Now, cranberries is a big issue, no? Did anyone ever eat a raw cranberry here?
Yeah.
You have?
I think the ocean
spray that.
What?
So the ocean spray raw cranberries are sweetened. That's why they're good. If you eat a unsweetened raw cranberry that you go somewhere up in Massachusetts and you pick it and you eat it, it's going to be really, really tart. And not only is it tart, apparently it is chewy in a disgusting sort of way. So therefore, the cranberries are a serious question of a Bishul Agam. A friend of mine, Mrs. Hillowitz from the show, her son, Chaim Hillowitz, is learning in the Kollel in Yerushalayim. The person who runs the Kollel is Aryeh Kolton, who's an old friend of mine from a million years ago. So Aryeh Kolton and his Kollel, they put out a whole pamphlet about Bishul Agam, and he kept on trying to talk to me that I should convince Rav Schechter that cranberries are a Bishul Agam problem. He spent like a long time that I should be his go-between and try to convince Rav Schechter that cranberries are a problem. Not successful, though he was still lenient on cranberries. The reason why he felt cranberries are a problem is because he felt that cranberries are necha ayidei hadechak only. A raw cranberry isn't really edible. And the raw cranberry isn't edible, so the cranberry sauce should be a problem of Bishul Agam. Because of cooked cranberry. However, the OU is lenient because there are a few recipes that you could find if you Google recipes with raw cranberries that are out there. There are recipes with raw cranberries that you could find and make. So, again, I don't know. I don't know exactly what the recipes are, but the OU is lenient because they found these recipes. It could be that cranberries are the type of necha ayudei hadechak that maybe should not be permitted. At least that's what this Aryeh Kolton was trying to suggest a few years ago. The fact is, we are lenient on cranberries. The OU is lenient on cranberries, certainly. Now, when we talk about foods that's nechal kamoshu chai, foods that are edible ruah, and therefore there's no Bishul Agam problem, the question is, does it have to be edible ruah where the food is eaten? What about if it's edible ruah where the food is manufactured, not where the food is eaten? For example, palm hearts. Okay? In Brazil, where they... hearts of palm, right? So... In Brazil, where they grow hearts of palm, they have full fields of it. It's like massive. So in Brazil, people eat raw palm hearts. In the United States, has anyone ever eaten a raw palm heart? But the stuff in the can that you get are cooked. They're cooked in the can. But in Brazil, people eat it raw. So the question is, can we be makel that's nechal kamo shulchai, even though no one in America ever eats it raw? The OU is lenient on this. And the reason why they're lenient on this is they say the only reason why Americans don't eat raw palm hearts is because we don't have access to them. And if we'd have access to them, they'd be really yummy and delicious, and we'd eat them all the time. That's their approach to palm hearts. Now, one of the issues that comes up in terms of food that's edible raw is what about milk? And this is one that no one ever thought about.
Well,
our milk is all cooked, no?
Except for those...
So there are certain people who are very crunchy. I think that's the official expression. And they will drink unpasteurized milk, no? But most people won't drink unpasteurized milk. Is the milk going to be kosher? It might not be nechal kamo shuchai. So the question is, is raw milk for us considered nechal kamo shuchai? The only reason why we don't eat raw milk or drink raw milk is because we're worried that there's some bacteria in it. But it's perfectly tasty, it's going to be fine. And so that is probably why we are lenient. However, there are other poskim who come up with additional reasons to be lenient. They don't think that that's enough of a reason. And they suggest that the Star K on their website, you see I have this thing that says foods whose form and taste do not change through cooking. That is a citation from the Star K website. And the Star K says that's why pasteurized milk is okay, because nothing changes when you cook it. It tasted like milk beforehand, it tastes like milk after. Since there's no real change, it's not subject to the rules of Bishul Akum. That line on the Star K website is very difficult, in my opinion. The first Shach in Hilchos Bishul Akum presents this Svara, but he says that Shulchan Aruch rejects that idea. For some reason, Rabbi Heinemann, I don't understand it, for some reason Rabbi Heinemann assumes that that reason is binding, even though the Shach rejects it. I give you the Shach over here in the next source. There are other reasons to permit the milk. Milk is not cooked in direct fire. Milk is cooked through steam in most cases. Most of the pasteurized milk is pasteurized through steam in retorts. So cooking through steam is a question in halacha, whether that's considered bishul akum. The reality is that since some are lenient on cooking in steam, that's why we are lenient on the milk. Milk is probably also nechal kmo shuchai. And the milk is edible when it is raw. Okay, yeah.
Then how does that, like with coffee, how does that relate to coffee?
How does it relate to coffee? Yeah, so coffee. So is coffee, why is coffee not a problem with Bishul Akum? Right?
Because you don't drink
the coffee bean itself is not edible raw. Coffee is the type of drink that I would serve at a fancy dinner. Shouldn't coffee be subject to the rules of Bishul Akum?
So, it's like a spice.
It's like a spice. So Tosfos says that Tosis asks a question about beer. Tosis asks, how come beer is not subject to the rules of Bishul Akum? How come everyone drinks beer? So Tosis says, well, beer, since the barley and the hops are butyl, they're nullified with respect to the water, the main drink of beer is water. And the barley just adds a little bit of... The barley just adds flavor to the water. So Tosis says, I have proof to this. What bracha do you make on beer? Do you make a mezonos that you make on barley? You make a shahakol. Tosis says you make a shahakol on beer. If you make a shahakol, that means that you're assuming that beer is really water. If it's water, so therefore it's not subject to the rules of Bishul Akum. Similarly, the post can say coffee is really water. Right? Mornings will never be the same. What?
Mezonos,
so that's a question. Mezonos can't be a tofel. The best answer to that question, Rabbi Zalman has an essay in his Sefer on the Rambam. Probably mezonos can't be a tofel when it's food. Liquids is a different thing. That's a whole other shiur to give. Not for now. Let's go on. The second rule of Bishul Akum is that in order to be subject to Bishul Akum, it has to be the type of food that would go al Shulchan Malachim, on the king's table. So you ask, like, falafel, right? That's because you're Israeli, and you assume that everyone eats falafel. Some people might say that maybe falafel does not go on the king's table. That's the question. So here in the neighborhood, they are very machmir. K.A.J. Hashgacha is extremely machmir because Rev Schwab met the Chazon Ish one time, and he asked the Chazon Ish whether sardines are subject to the rules of Bishul Akum. So the Chazon Ish said in Yiddish, which I can't imitate, he said something to the effect of, what do you think the king for England eats for breakfast? Now, everyone ate sardines in Europe. The Chazon Ish was machmir not to. Breuer's is machmir on sardines. Breuer says that the definition of ola al shulchan malachim means food that is not lousy.
Like taste?
Right? Food that is not inferior quality. Any food that is inferior quality is not Olah Shulchan Alechem. Food that is a decent quality food, so a king would eat anything. Right? That's the basic idea. What do you think the king eats? Right? I remember a few years ago when George Bush was the president, he once choked on a pretzel. Remember that?
Mm.
Right? Are pretzels Olah Shulchan Alechem? Right? Or potato chips? Are they Olah Shulchan Alechem? Do we assume that these foods, right, a king would eat them? So, generally speaking, the definition of Ola al Shulchan Malachim is not what the Chazon Ish told Rav Schwab. It's not anything a king would eat. And the definition of Ola al Shulchan Malachim is probably not what the Star K has on their website also. The Star K on their website, everyone asks, how come potato chips is not subject to Bishul Akkad? Now, of course, if you'd ask in this neighborhood, why is potato chips not subject to Bishul Akkam? So K.A.J. Hashgacha would say, potato chips are subject to Bishul Akkam, that's why we only give Hashgacha on Lieber's potato chips. I remember there used to be a store here in town called Monikers, and in Monikers you could not buy Wise potato chips. You could only buy Lieber's potato chips. Am I right? So the reason why you couldn't buy Wise potato chips in Monikers is because K.A.J. Hashgacha felt that Wise potato chips were treif. I think that he tried to only have products that were approved by the Kehillah. I mean, they were open the second day, Yontiv, right? Monikers kept by rules of... Oh, it was great. You could go shopping in like the kosher-owned store in town on the second day, Yontiv. This you remember, right?
Yeah.
Monikers is open the second day, Yontiv.
What? They were...
No?
No.
Remember?
I can't believe.
You know, no. Okay, it could be my memory is wrong.
Things in the freezer that were there for like years.
When there's a zochah,
what?
When there's a shol zochah in the neighborhood, you would open up so that people, you know, there's all the simcha could get some food out.
And
pay afterwards, but normally.
Uh-huh. I'm just reporting the way Rav Schechter says it over. I don't know.
That's important.
But the fact is, why is potato chips not subject to Bishul Akkam? A potato chip is a potato. Right? It's just a potato that's sliced very thin, correct? And it's fried. Right? And it's fried with lots and lots of oil. That's what a potato chip is. So shouldn't a potato chip be Bishul Akkam? Because potatoes go on the king's table, so potato chips also. It's just a very thinly sliced potato. So K.A.J. says potato chips have Bishul Akkam problems. The Star K on their website, they write that they contacted the White House state dinner policy. You see that segment?
Yeah.
And they say that the White House state dinner says that they would never serve potato chips. And based on this, the Star K is lenient on potato chips or Bishul Akkam. That is very, very difficult because presumably has nothing to do with whether the White House would serve it. It doesn't mean a state dinner, right? Olah Shulchan Malachim probably means a fancy meal. The concern isn't that I'm going to marry Sasha or Malia Obama, right? The concern is that I am going to marry some daughter of whoever's cooking the food. It doesn't have to be a state dinner. Yeah, Ben?
No, I just remember reading like trivia as a kid that potato chips were invented because some king wanted his french fries very thin.
That's interesting. We'll talk about... Okay, so if the king really eats it, we'll have to talk about why would potato chips be mutter... And the answer basically is Reb Usher Weiss has the following svar in his sefer on Parashas Devarim. Reb Usher Weiss in the Milchas Usher suggests that one of the halachos of Bishul Akkam that we haven't discussed is Bishul Akkam has to be food that's served in a meal. It has to be something that is melafes asapas that comes together with bread. Snack foods, by definition, are excluded from Bishul Akkam. That's his... What?
Tuna sandwich.
So tuna goes in the sandwich.
Yeah,
so tuna is... Right? Let's take a few more questions.
I don't know if we're running out of time, just a reminder you asked me to ask you
about the restaurant. Okay. So basically the issue with a lot of these vegan restaurants is, first of all, you have to be worried. Not everything that's vegan is kosher. There's issues like balsamic vinegar and stuff. Many of the vinegars... So the ones that have hashgacha, they solve the Bishul Akkam problem by either having a pilot light left on or by having the mashgiach turn on the fires or something like that. But vegan restaurants that don't have hashgacha really would be a problem of Bishul Akkam. Now, it's not... just because the ingredients are kosher doesn't mean that the food is kosher. That's basically...
But the stuff that they're given is a little bit...
What?
The stuff that they're given is
a little... So, again, some of the hashgachos are better, some of the hashgachos are...
I've seen every vegan restaurant that I've been to has the same one.
But at the very least, they're having a pilot lighter. There's someone starting
the assumption is that that's what they do. Again, some of these hashgachos are notoriously supervised by dead people. Or, what can we do? Yeah, Alon?
So, who said that when Chazal mentioned Shulchan Melachim, they meant the president of the United States? I mean, like, isn't it like a...
Correct!
So, the Star K website, I don't know. Rav Heinemann's a very big Talmud Chacham, but I don't understand. This is straight from the Star K website. Right? This is cut and paste. The Star K website says that they permit it because they don't serve potato chips in the White House. Yeah, David? So, you know, you can make it pretty close. You slice a potato very thin and you fry it. And you salt it. I don't think...
I went to the Hertz factory once, and they had a whole system with, like, huge machines, how they're making all the different chips and stuff.
Now, okay. It happens that the OU has a different cool about potato chips. The OU assumes that the reason why potato chips are... not subject to Bishul Akum, is because fried potatoes are never served at fancy meals, but the type of potatoes that they'll serve at fancy meals are basically baked potatoes that they add some spices to them to make them look fried. But a fried potato will never be served at fancy meals. That's what Rabbi Belsky says. I don't know. I don't go to enough fancy meals to comment, but it's an interesting idea. I don't know if it's... Right, at Mount Sinai. Okay.
That's true.
That's fancy.
So potato chips is a big issue in terms of Bishul Akum. Let's just talk about sushi for a minute. So traditionally it was assumed that fish were a problem with Bishul Akum because fish is something that you don't eat raw. Today, people eat sushi raw. Sushi, not all species of fish are used for sushi, but those species of fish that are used for sushi are certainly edible raw in our society. I don't know if it would carry over to other societies. There are still people out there who get freaked out by eating raw fish, but in our society that people eat sushi, so fish is not subject to the rules of Bishul Akum. The issue with sushi is, right, first of all, you have to identify the fish as a kosher species of fish, right, which means that you have to see the scales. The Gemara says that there's no such thing as a fish that has scales but not fins. So therefore, if you identify the scales, you know it's a kosher fish. Very often, you get the fish in sushi, you can't see the scales. So that's going to be a problem. But salmon might be okay, because salmon has a unique color. There is no fish that is used for food that has the same color as salmon, besides salmon. There are other fish with the same color as salmon, but they swim around in your aquarium. They are tropical fish. There is no fish that's used for food that has the same color as salmon. So as such, salmon is assumed to be kosher based on the simin of the color. The problem that came up a number of years ago with the salmon is that there's a type of dye called anastaxis, which is... what? And it makes it salmon colored. So they could make a tray fish technically the same color. So the OU is still lenient on salmon per se, because salmon that is, or a fish that is dyed with this anastaxis dye does not look the same as salmon. The anastaxis dye won't dye it'll dye the flesh of the fish, but there's going to be little white strands in between. Salmon will be a uniform color throughout, so therefore the OU is still lenient on the salmon. So if you have a piece of sashimi, is that true? Is that what the word is called?
Yes, it is.
Right? So sashimi, if it's coming from salmon, it's completely non-cooked and it's non-flavored. You go to a treif restaurant and you can get a piece of sashimi, no?
What
about
the rice?
But we'll talk about the rice and the sushi in a minute. Sashimi is just a plain piece of fish. So a plain piece of fish would be okay. Now, are you allowed to eat on the treif utensils? So, basically, in a ba'akroi, on an occasional basis, we are mekel to eat on the tref utensils as well. So the sashimi should be okay, but it has to be completely unflavored. If it is flavored, so all bets are off. If they add any vinegar, anything to it, so then there would be... but if it's just a plain lump of fish, they're cutting it with a treif knife. I'm not supposed to eat something that's cut with a treif knife. So the answer is what I really should do is take a plastic knife and cut off the edge and then eat it. But technically speaking, that is kosher. That should work. It might not be practical, but technically speaking, that is okay. Well, again?
Because there are other... salmon, the only fish that is...
So you have to make sure you get a piece of salmon, right? Other fish are only going to be kosher if you see the scales. Now, by the time it comes to you on the plate, you're not going to see the scales. So I think that is true. Now, in terms of the sushi has... fish, and it has rice in it. So the fish is edible ruah. Rice is not edible ruah. Rice should be subject to the rules of bishul akum. But now the question comes up, what is the ikar? When you eat sushi, what bracha do you make? Now most people make a mizonos on rice and a shahakol on fish, right? What bracha do you make on sushi? Do you assume that the fish is the ikar, the fish is your main intention, or do you assume that the rice is the ikar? Anyone want to take a stab at this one? I have no idea. I'm divided on it. But the real shiloh would be the bishul akum shiloh on the sushi. Because the rules of bishul akum are governed by the same rules as brachos. Right? That's why Tosis says that beer, since you make a shahakol on it, it's not subject to bishul akum. So if sushi is, right, if the main part of the sushi would be the fish, so then the rice, again, assuming that the rice is made in a kosher pot, very hard assumption, right? In all likelihood, you can't have the rice because the treif restaurant is going to cook pork in the same pot that they're cooking the rice. So there's really no, right? It's not just a bishul akum issue. There are issues of genuine treifus in that rice. But if we could isolate and say that the only issue with the rice is the bishul akum, so the question is, what's the ikar in my sushi? Is the ikar my fish or my rice? If the ikar is my fish, so then one could say that there's no prohibition of bishul akum on the rice because the rice is going to be batal, it's a tofel, it's secondary to the main purpose, which is the fish, and we follow the rules of ikar and tofel by bishul akum. Yeah, David? So if it's a dedicated rice cooker, so we still have to contend with the possible bishul akum if the rice is ikar. The rice fills me up. The fish adds flavor. No? And so we have to deal with that. I'm not convinced. I'm not sure which one is the ikar in the sushi. But there's another problem in the sushi. I'll get to your question in a second, called the nori. Right? The nori is like the seaweed base. So the seaweed is treif, probably, because the seaweed has possibilities of certain treif ingredients added, and there's also a bug issue in the non-supervised seaweed. So the even if you hold that the fish is the ikar, and therefore there'd be no bishul akum problem on the sushi, but you still have to contend with the nori, I strongly recommend avoiding sushi besides in kosher establishments because I think there'd be a real bishul akum problem potentially if the rice is the main thing. And additionally, I think the nori is a problem of the bugs, and perhaps there are some other things that are mixed into it as well, so that could be a problem. Yeah, you had a question? Okay.
And if you say that the ikar is the fish, then that all adds up. So I think you're saying that it's not.
Right, then, again, right, but the only issue then would be the nori, and I assume that if it's only kosher fish, you'd have some sort of supervision. That's my guess. That's interesting. Don't know. Yeah.
Well, I think you put stuff in the rice. I mean, you put vinegar in the rice.
They do add stuff to the rice?
Okay. Yeah. Like when you make sushi at home, they always add stuff to it. But, I had a question with the fish, because when it comes to sushi, you usually use a certain quality of fish. Does that make a difference in terms of like applying it to all types of damage?
Yeah, so that's a very hard question to answer. We generally assume that we follow the way the species of the food. If it's the same species, just one's a higher quality, one's a lower quality, I don't think we would cut along those lines. So again, these are some of the issues that I wanted to discuss in terms of Bishul Akam specifically. Obviously, there's a lot more to discuss. Maybe we'll take some questions after. I did promise also that we would talk about that new frozen yogurt shop that opened on 181st Street. So here's the story.
Where's that?
There's a frozen yogurt shop that opened on 181st between Fort Wash and Bennett. It's called Yo Sweets. So Yo Sweets has on their business cards that they give out, they have a little OU. No?
Yeah.
It says Yo Sweets, OUD Kosher Certified. They just got the letter from the OU for trademark infringement. The OU is not certifying Yo Sweets. Okay. Yo Sweet does purchase, or they say they purchase, some yogurt flavors that are made in an OU factory. That is certainly true. However, we don't know that the only flavors. Today I spent an hour with the guy and he showed me, he has 29 pages from the OU of flavors that he buys, and say, what else do you buy? So he also buys a bunch of other flavors. And many of the other flavors that he buys have a star D, which are okay, but there are some that don't. There was a yogurt shop in the Bronx recently, near Einstein, that had a similar issue, that they were saying that's all OU supervised, and some of it was. In fact, the chocolate and vanilla was OU supervised, but some of the other flavors weren't. And if there's no one overseeing, if there's no one overseeing what's going on, so especially because it's a specialty shop and they're mixing flavors, they're trying to make innovative flavors, we just don't know what is going in there. So I strongly advise that you not eat in Yo Sweets now. Even the stuff that they say is coming from kosher OU sources, still, we just don't know what's going on. There's no one overseeing. At the same time, we are working with them, and we hope to have supervision. It could be we won't be able to get Hashgacha on the entire store because he's resistant to closing on Shabbos. And it could be that we won't be able to get Hashgacha on the entire store, but we might be able to give some Hashgacha just on the yogurt machines. But as of now, I recommend not eating in Yo Sweets because we just are not sure what's going on. The guy's a good guy. He's a wonderful guy. He wanted to help the community. We're very appreciative. It's a really nice place. And we're very appreciative that they're opening up, and it would benefit us, and I hope that we'll be working together. The fact that he got this letter from the OU for copyright infringement is working to our advantage. Because he's like, oh my gosh, I really thought I was kosher. Now what do I do? I'm like, okay, let's talk. Right? So we're going to be working together. I hope, I can't guarantee it, I don't know. Unlike the sushi and falafel store, where the guy who owns the store is an Orthodox Jew and who understood kashrus, this Raymond, the owner of the store there, is not Jewish by any standard, and he doesn't really know what he's getting into in terms of kashrus. I mentioned to him that like it costs money to get kosher supervision. He was a little taken aback. But at the same time, it would benefit the community. I told him that if he gets kosher supervision, I can guarantee him that we'd have lots and lots of people going to buy frozen yogurt, which I think is a fair statement. So that's what I wanted to say regarding Yo Sweets. And I'm around if anyone has any other questions, but I want to thank all of you for coming and listening. And Riva and Yoni, thank you for putting this together.